Categorizing the style of Paul Cézanne's artwork is problematic. As a young man, he left his home in Provence in the south of France in order to join with the avant-garde in Paris. He was successful, too. He fell in with the circle of young painters that surrounded Manet. He had been a childhood friend of the novelist Emile Zola, who championed Manet, and he even showed at the first Impressionist exhibition held at Nader Studio in 1874. However, Cézanne didn't quite fit in with the group. Whereas many other painters in the circle were concerned primarily with the effects of light and reflected color, Cézanne remained deeply committed to form. Feeling out of place in Paris, he left after a relatively short period and returned to his home in Aix-en-Provence. He would remain in his native province for most of the rest of his life. He worked in the semi-isolation afforded by the country, but was never really out of touch with the breakthroughs of the avant-garde. Like the Impressionists, he often worked outdoors directly before his subjects, but unlike the Impressionists, Cézanne used color, not as an end in itself, but rather like line, as a tool with which to construct form and space. Ironically, it is the Parisian avant-garde that would eventually seek him out. In the first years of the 20th century, just at the end of Cézanne's life, young artists would make a pilgrimage to Aix to see the man who would change painting. Paul Cézanne is often considered to be one of the most influential painters of the 19th century. Pablo Picasso readily admitted his great debt to the elder master. Similarly, Henri Matisse once called Cézanne the father of us all. For many years, the Museum of Modern Art in New York organized its permanent collection so as to begin with an entire room devoted to Cézanne's painting. The Metropolitan Museum of Art also gives over an entire large room to him. Clearly, many artists and curators consider him enormously important. It can be difficult to estimate by eye just how far away a mountain lies. A peak can dominate a landscape and command our attention, filling our eyes and our mind. Yet, it can come as somewhat of shock to discover that such a prominent natural feature can still be a long distance from us. At 3,317 feet, or 1,011 meters high, the limestone peak of Mont Saint-Victoire is a pygmy compared to the giants of, say, Mount Fuji and Mount Rainier. But, like them, it still exercises a commanding presence over the country around it, and in particular over Aix-en-Provence, the hometown of Paul Cézanne. Thanks to his many oil paintings and watercolors of the mountain, the painter has become indelibly associated with it. Think of Cézanne and his still lifes and landscapes come to mind, his apples and his depictions of Mont Saint-Victoire. Steeped in centuries of history and folklore, both classical and Christian, the mountain, or more accurately, the mountain range, only gradually emerged as a major theme in Cézanne's work. In the 1870s, he included it in a landscape called the Railway Cutting, 1870, and a few years later it appeared behind the monumental figures of his Bathers at Rest, 1876-77, which also included in the Third Impressionist exhibition of 1877. But it wasn't until the beginning of the next decade, well after his adoption of Impressionism, that he began to consistently feature the mountain in his landscapes. Writing in 1885, Paul Gauguin was probably thinking of Mont Saint-Victoire when he imagined Cézanne spending entire days in the mountains reading Virgil and looking at the sky. Therefore, Gauguin continued, his horizons are high, his blues very intense, and the red in his work has an astounding vibrancy. Cézanne's legacy was beginning to emerge, and a mountain ran through it. Cézanne would return to the motif of Mont Saint-Victoire throughout the rest of his career, resulting in an incredibly varied series of works. They show the mountain from many different points of view, and often in relationship to a constantly changing cast of other elements, foreground trees and bushes, buildings and bridges, fields and quarries. From this series, we can extract a subgroup of over 24 paintings and watercolors. Dating from the very last years of the artist's life, these landscapes feature a heightened lyricism and, more prosaically, a consistent point of view. They show the mountain as it can be seen from the hills of Le Louvre, located just north of Aix. Cézanne bought an acre of land on this hill in 1901, and by the end of the following year he had built a studio on it. From here, he would walk further uphill to a spot that offered a sweeping view of Mont Saint-Victoire and the land before it. The painter Emile Bonnard recalled accompanying Cézanne on this very walk. Cézanne picked up a box in the hall of his studio and took me to his motif. It was 2 kilometers away with a view over a valley at the foot of Saint-Victoire, the craggy mountain which he never ceased to paint. He was filled with admiration for this mountain. Cézanne consciously cultivated his association with the mountain and perhaps even wanted to be documented painting it. When they visited Aix in 1906, the artists Maurice Denis and Carr Xavier Russell found themselves being led in the same direction. In an oil painting by Denis, in the same of Russell's photos, we see Cézanne standing before his easel and painting the mountain, again. It was the view we can see in most of Cézanne's late views of Mont Saint-Victoire, including the painting that concerns us here, which is now in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. In this work, Cézanne divides his composition into roughly 3 horizontal sections, which extend across the 3-foot-wide canvas. Our viewpoint is elevated. Closest to us lies a band of foliage and houses. Next, rough patches of yellow ochre, emerald, and variegated in green suggest the patchwork of an expansive plain and extend the foreground's color scheme into the middle ground. And above, in contrasting blues and violets and grays, we can see the craggy mountains surrounded by sky. The blues seen in this section also accent the rest of the work, while conversely, touches of green enliven the sky and mountain. In other words, Cézanne introduced subtle adjustments in order to avoid too simple a scheme. So the peak of the mountain is pushed just to the right of center, and the horizon line inclines gently upwards from left to right. In fact, a complicated counterpoint of diagonals can be found in each of the work's bands, in the roofs of the houses, in the lines of the mountain, and in the arrangement of the patches in the plain, which connect foreground to background and lead the eye back. Cézanne evokes a deep panoramic scene in the atmosphere that fills and unifies the space, but it is absolutely characteristic of his art that we also remain acutely aware of the painting as a fairly rough, if deftly worked, surface. Flatness coexists with depth, and we find ourselves caught between these two poles, now more aware of one, now the other. The mountainous landscape is both within our reach, yet far away.